So our first speaker, okay, is Dina Romo. Let me get back to my notes. The first speaker is Dr. Zun Wangu. She is with the University of Massachusetts Memorial Children's Medical Center, and currently that's where she completed her fellowship, but she's currently at the Rotella PTC in Boston. And the title of her talk is A Perfect Storm of Noncompliance: Chlamydia trachomatis infection and progressive pelvic inflammatory disease in an adolescent patient. Dr. Wangu.
Thank you and good morning. So today I'm going to present to you a very interesting and challenging case I saw in our adolescent clinic at UMass. So the chief complaint is abdominal pain, and this is a very common complaint we see in pediatrics clinics. So this is a young lady, 15 years old, had, besides the abdominal pain, some nausea just for the past day, really no other symptoms at all. She does have a history of constipation, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, disruptive mood disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And unfortunately, the PTSD was secondary to molestation from an aunt and uncle when she was about 6 to 7 years old. At this visit, she had totally normal vital signs, but her exam was very consistent with constipation. And of course, this being adolescent clinic and you being the audience, you know, we definitely asked about what she was doing in the bedroom. And she said, I'm not having sex. I've never had sex before. And I'm not sure what's going on today. So I'm going to show you what happened with her on this timeline. And so initially, she saw our nurse practitioner in clinic. And the NP was a little bit skeptical, as this audience is too, right? So her chlamydia urine NAT was positive. So she was called back for follow-up and discussion. And I ended up meeting her on day 3 of her symptoms. So she did not have a fever, but I was very concerned for PID. She had uterine and cervical motion tenderness. Her abdominal pain was much worse. Her other testing, including urine pregnancy, was negative. Very interesting dynamic here is that she said, so surprised, I was having sex for the past 2 months, but I was not comfortable discussing it at the initial visit. And she said, my mom knows I'm having sex, but she won't let me get birth control. So that was very interesting. But she said, you know, I'm really worried that I'm going to get pregnant, and so can you please give me birth control because I'm not ready to be a mom. So she did show a fair level of insight and responsibility. And so we gave her depo confidentially at that visit. We also treated her for PID and gave her a prescription for azithromycin for her partner. We don't have medication in our clinic, so we gave her a prescription. She was very interested in that as well. So we wanted to follow up with her in about a week, so midway through her course for PID. But then, of course, as something always happens in adolescent patients, something happened. So she ended up having a fist fight with her mother at home. We don't know exactly what happened, but people were thrown against walls and whatnot. So she was actually taken out of her mom's custody. She was placed in a residential program, and she was supposed to finish her medications there. So unfortunately, she only took about 2 doses of her antibiotics at home because it upset her stomach. But unfortunately, she did not call us to tell us that so we could maybe talk about other therapies. So she had continued abdominal pain, came back to clinic. Now that she was in the residential program, our nurse practitioner said, okay, let me give you a repeat course and monitor you because now you're in a monitored setting at this program where they know when you're taking your meds, when you're not taking your meds. So she had follow-up by phone with our nurse in a couple days, and the program said, oh, now she's not taking anything. She refuses all medication. Now she had vaginal bleeding. Her abdominal pain had come back. It was much worse. No discharge. And so they brought her to the emergency room. And she had a very concerning pelvic ultrasound. She had endometritis, cystitis, loss of pelvic free fluid. And so she was admitted for parenteral therapy to our children's hospital. So quickly, adolescent STI burden and risk. So we know adolescents bear quite a burden of these diseases. Chlamydia, gonorrhea account for about 50. Adolescents and young adults account for about 50% of gonorrhea and chlamydia cases yearly in the U.S. And of course, we know about the burden of syphilis in young MSM of color, for example. Other factors increasing risk are many. So even if you just think about the dynamic and the understanding of STDs, the conversation between mom and this patient in this case, lower levels of condom use, I think Dr. Burstein mentioned that many times yesterday in her talk. We also don't see teens using many condoms in our practice. Lots of sexual partners, and then very complex sexual networks, and the concept of concurrency is very important here too in our teens. So there, I like to think of the susceptibility in adolescents for STIs as a horrible two-headed beast. And so one of the heads is biological susceptibility. So in adolescent girls, there is cervical ectopy, which is basically this red area here that you see around the cervical os. And that's just single-layered columnar epithelium. In adult women, they have multi-layered squamous epithelium in that area. And so the difference is that the columnar epithelium is more susceptible to organism attachment and then penetration, including ascension to the upper reproductive tract as well. So this is seen in Chlamydia trachomatis, which seems to have a predilection for infecting this type of epithelium, and gonorrhea may have preferential attachment to this type of cell. Also, these girls have less estrogenization, they have poor lubrication during intercourse, and the cervical mucus is thinner, so all of these factors work against them and kind of almost encourage the organisms to go into the upper reproductive tract more easily and cause PID in this case. The other head of the beast is then cognitive and behavioral susceptibility, and this young lady had a lot of factors working against her. So in general, this is a very unique stage of development, adolescence. They're struggling between childhood in order to assert themselves as an adult, and in that transition, they're taking a lot of risks to figure out the world. They have a desire for autonomy. And especially for middle adolescence, in which this patient was, she was 15, they have the myth of invulnerability. So everyone else will get chlamydia, but never me. This will never happen to me. Lots of limited knowledge. They don't know what STIs are, how they can present. How could I have chlamydia and just have some abdominal pain? Fear of disclosure to guardians. Clearly in this case. And then this patient also, while she did not have any history of substance abuse, had several mental health issues and sexual trauma in her history as well. So when we think about how to treat adolescents for PID, are there any things we need to think of additionally when we compare it to adult women? So there is not a lot of representation for early and middle adolescents. So in the PEACH trial, this is a trial looking at women with mild to moderate PID and comparing whether some initial parenteral therapy followed by outpatient therapy was any different from purely outpatient therapy. And the clinical outcomes were quite similar, and overall it was found to not be cost-effective to have that initial inpatient therapy, again for mild or moderate disease. And this trial was open to women as young as 14 years of age, but when you look at the mean ages of those younger than 19, the mean was actually 18. So is there anything we need to think about for early and middle adolescents because their development is quite immature compared to these older adolescents? So we know the standard PID regimens per the CDC. I'm not going to belabor the point. But the main thing we had to think about was, are there any IM or oral regimens we could have used in place of what we did use, which was the cephalosporin, doxycycline, and metronidazole? So there are two studies, 2003 and 2007, looking at azithromycin-based regimens. So one was azithromycin IV for a couple doses, and then azithromycin to complete 14 days plus minus metronidazole. These women were older. They were in their late 20s. Short-term clinical effectiveness, long-term clinical effectiveness. Many of these women did have recurrent disease, and that would be a whole other conversation. But just to say that we've looked into some of these other regimens. And then in 2007, similar aged women in their late 20s looked at azithromycin and then ceftriaxone, which this patient did get. So you always want to consider coverage for anaerobes. We don't have any data for oral cephalosporins in PID, and for many reasons, quinolones are no longer routinely recommended, particularly with GC resistance. This patient did not end up having very close follow-up, so using a quinolone in this case would just be playing with fire, so it didn't even enter my mind to try that. So just back to the case, so this patient was admitted. My colleague saw her on the pediatric ID service. She ended up getting an azithromycin-only regimen. She really showed a total lack of concern or insight, so that initial maturity and thinking that I thought she displayed at the initial visit, she was sort of laughing throughout provider conversations and saying, oh, whatever, it's fine. And at the program, they had to say, no TV, no internet, no going outside, no phone until you take your medicine. So she said, all right, I guess I'll do that. She did finish her medication, and her follow-up testing was negative. So some of the points that I learned from this case, this patient had a lot of factors working against her in many ways. There's not a lot of evidence for best practice PID strategies in this age of patient, and I'll be interested to hear what our discussants think about her therapy. And you might need an alternative PID regimen to ensure successful treatment. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Wangu, for a very interesting case. So now I'd like to invite our discussants to come up to the front. So, as they come up, I'd like to introduce Dr. Hunter Hansfield. He's a professor with the University of Washington Center for AIDS and STD in Seattle, Washington.
Can we cover up the projector?
Okay, our second discussant is Dr. Christine Johnson. She's with the University of Washington STD Prevention Training Center in Seattle. And last but not least, we have Dr. Dina Romo, who actually completed her training at NYC STD HIV Prevention Training Center in Columbia, but she's now currently at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, Jacoby Hospital. Fortunately, she is a pediatric ID and deals with adolescents.
Pediatric adolescent, okay.
So I'd like to address my first question to Dr. Romo. So this case really brings up some ethical issues about treatment of minors. So we know that all 50 states explicitly allow minors to consent for their own health services for STDs, although some states restrict minor consent to certain services. How would you address some of these ethical considerations in the care of this minor with respect to her compliance and lack of consent?
Morning, everybody. Thanks for having me. So as Zune mentioned, this is definitely a complicated case given her psychosocial situation. I think it depends. It's not a clear-cut black and white straightforward picture, but I think it depends on the family dynamics. We've certainly had patients that be diagnosed with PID and don't want their parents to know or don't want them to know the extent of how they got this illness. And given the fact that she was in a difficult psychosocial situation with her family, it sounds like she had been removed from her home and now was in a residential program, that tells me that she, you know, the relationship with her parents is tumultuous, and probably is not gonna be one that is understanding or one that is gonna be supportive in her medical treatment course. So that's something to keep in mind. I think that we have to take into consideration also, one, her non-adherence and the fact that if PID progresses, it can become more toxic and even life-threatening. So that's something to bear in mind, and that's when you have to consider when is your threshold to kind of get parents involved. I think also, there's some finesse into discussing some of these issues with the parents. So, I think it's fine to explain to the parents that she has a pelvic infection. if they're going to be supportive in her treatment. And you might not necessarily need to divulge all the details that this, you know, how she may have acquired this illness. But if they are going to be supportive with her adherence, that may be a conversation worth having with the parent. So it all depends. But this is a sexual, in New York City anyway, and in many states, minors have the capacity to consent for medical care, especially around sexual health and reproduction. So I would say that this is, you know, this can be considered one of those cases. But again, not so black and white.
Thank you. So Dr. Johnson, can you comment on the efficacy or cure rates with azithromycin? Dr. Wangu showed that some of the clinical trials had involved azithro, specifically with respect to treatment of upper tract infection for chlamydia trachomatis compared to doxy.
Yes, and thank you for having me as well. You know, I think you presented the trials of azithromycin and already mentioned that they really did not involve adolescents. They were in older women. Those trials, one of the trials was a non-inferiority trial comparing doxycycline to azithromycin along with ceftriaxone, and metronidazole was not used in that trial. That was a trial that used azithromycin 1 gram once a week for 2 weeks. And in that study, they actually had very high cure rates, over 95% for the azithromycin arm and actually only about 90% for doxy. So that actually looked better than, azithromycin looked better than doxy. In that study, they did only look at mild PID, so this is a very different case with severe. The other trial that looked at azithromycin versus doxy also looked at mild PID. In that study, both the cure rates were well over 95%. So I think that they are, azithromycin is listed in the CDC guidelines as an alternative treatment for doxycycline. I would be curious in your case if you considered the 1 gram once a week dose instead just because of her really difficult compliance issues. I think I would have some hesitancy to do that in this case, especially because of her more severe disease.
And I think the 1 gram, we've seen a lot of issues with GI tolerance.
So I felt like if I let her go, relying on the fact that she was 1 gram, that might get people. Dr. Wangu, would you like to come up, please? Okay.
So that's a great point. So we decided not to do the 1 gram because we've seen a lot of issues with GI tolerance for 1 gram of azithromycin, and we were concerned that this patient would refund the 1 gram at her residential program. So we thought that the 250 might be easier for tolerance, but that's an excellent point.
All right, Dr. Hansfield. So the treatment guidelines state that we should consider metronidazole in every treatment regimen for PID, considering the contribution of anaerobes to upper tract infection. So would you encourage metronidazole in this case?
I think metronidazole in PID is delicious icing to the cake. I think it is absolutely wise to do, but I imagine that the differential efficacy, because there's certainly data, the tetracyclines alone are not bad anti-anaerobic drugs. They cover most well. They have excellent pharmacokinetics in terms of getting drug where you want it. And metronidazole upsets a lot of stomachs and can cause problems. And I don't know exactly the dynamic of why this young woman took only a dose or two, but I wouldn't be surprised if the metronidazole was the problem. And so I would always attempt to include metronidazole, but I would not go hover in the corner in quivering fear of the outcome if the metronidazole can't be given, even in relatively severe cases. I think there were other options here. I actually disagree with your I'm not going to go there comment or whatever it was about the fluoroquinolones. You have reasonably good evidence that gonorrhea is not an issue in this person. Even if it is, there's a difference in what you would expect with multiple dose therapy over a week or two compared with single dose therapy in terms of at least the not totally resistant, the middle ground relatively resistant GC. So I would not have been unhappy with quinolones. I think that, but sulfatrimethoprim is another option that we tend to forget about as an excellent pharmacokinetically excellent antibiotic for an awful lot of what ails you with a broad mix of. So the question really comes up is when you have a particular situation and none of the approved regimens fits, I think clinicians should not be so adherent to finding something that is written down in the guidelines if there are logically other things that could do. And antibiotics in general, unlike some of the kinds of therapy we use, think of chemotherapy, the ability to accurately predict clinical efficacy based on activity against the likely pathogens plus pharmacokinetics and so on is actually very, very good. So I don't have as much fear of finding regimens. Now, it sounds to me, however, that in this person, the problem wasn't so much what you were to give her, but to get her to make something. And within these realms of options that you used and that we're talking about, I'm not sure I would have rated every single one of them as equally okay, but any of them would serve if that's what I could get her to take.
That's an excellent point about the fluoroquinolones. And just to clarify, I was thinking more not to use them as first line during her initial visit. But certainly I would not hesitate to use fluoroquinolones. Another issue that comes up in pediatrics is, oh, she's under 18, we can't use them. And we use them all the time. They're excellent drugs for many indications. I always explain with parents the studies with, you know, the beagle puppies having tendonitis and what does that mean? And please don't Google this, which they will anyway. But for that reason alone, I would never have hesitation using fluoroquinolones. But as you mentioned, it was basically finding something that she would actually take. But that's a great point.
Can I just ask, was her hesitancy to take medication because she was fearful of the side effects? I mean, she did take the first couple of doses and then sounded like she had a lot of GI side effects. Or was she more just really not wanting to deal with having this infection and not wanting to undergo treatment?
I think it was a combination of both. When I asked her, I'm pretty sure it was the metronidazole that gave her GI upset, but by the time we discussed other regimens with her, she was completely over it and just didn't even want to deal with this because now she's in the hospital, her mom is asking her why, and so it was both.
Would she have accepted parenteral therapy? Would you talk about IV or about using Suboxone and or even Ceftriaxone IM because it would only have to be every 24 hours.
Yeah.
Did those options come up?
Yeah, we actually discussed all of those with her, and she was adamant, like, if you don't give me something oral, I'm going to run away somewhere. So this was extremely challenging, but, yeah, we did offer all of those to her as well.
I think also something to keep in mind is the fact that she is adolescent, and because all these biological and psychosocial factors come into play, so we really have to have very close follow-up with these patients. And usually, if we're going to do outpatient therapy, what we tend to do and what most recommendations are is to have patients come back within 48 hours to see, one, how clinically they're progressing, if they're improving, but also, two, to just check in to see, are they being compliant with their medications? What are the issues with adherence, to encourage adherence, and to kind of just, you know, a lot of repetition is important because they are in the stage of life where their cognitive development may not be able to fully understand all the, risks that she is getting herself into as far as like future complications. So I would have recommended in this case to have her come back in 48 hours rather than a week, just because it gives her so much time to kind of, you know, mess up the regimen. And at that point, if she's not being adherent or if she's not tolerating that outpatient regimen, that is an indication for inpatient treatment.
Okay, great. So thank you, Dr. Wangu and discussants, and I'll turn this over to our second case moderator, Dr. Borkowski.